Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Be the Right Club Today podcast. Hal, what's happening?
Not much. Just I played last week and realized that I got to get back into the golf.
we keep talking about it, right? Like, got to find time to get out there and go play some. When you're, it's the ongoing joke when you're in the golf business, you don't get to play golf anymore.
Yeah, well, I find that to be very true, as a matter of fact.
Well, we got a golf school coming up at Boot Ranch the next couple of days. You'll get to dust off the cobwebs and get to play some golf on a golf course that you like a little bit.
Yeah, I hope I can move any expectations to the side and just enjoy the time. So I am looking forward to getting back out.
So some of my favorite podcasts, obviously, you know, we enjoy doing them together. We obviously enjoy our guests too, but some of my favorite ones have been Q&As. And so this one's a Q&A. Before we get, and we got a lot of great questions. But before we get started, we got a shout out to two of our students. Gerlene Kaur is playing in the ANA/Chevron out in Palm Springs. It's her second major in the span of about 10 months. So she's a longtime student of ours, and have to give her a quick shout out. And we also need a shout out to Mr. Callum McNeil, who has Monday qualified into his second straight Korn Ferry Tour event, which is, for those of you out there that don't know much about that process, it is almost practically impossible to do that. He shot 8 under back-to-back rounds, back-to-back weeks to get in, and had a rough go with his caddy last week and in his first full Korn Ferry Tour start. And so he came, kind of got off, regained his momentum, let's say, and had some success again. So we've got to give shout outs to them and wish them both good luck this week.
Oh, they'll both play well. They're a good frame of mind now. Yes. So, we're always pulling for all of our students, not just the two of them, but we pull for as hard for them as we did for ourselves, don't we?
That's exactly right. And probably get a little more nervous watching the results sometimes, or watching them, than we did over shots ourselves. At least I feel like a parent half the time. Let's get after this. We got a lot of good questions. Thank you guys for giving us a bunch of good questions, and we'll get started with one of our previous podcast guests, good friend of ours, Mr. Phil Blackmar asked, if you were 21 right now, knowing what you know, would you change anything about your game? Would you have done anything differently?
That's a great question right there. Leave it to Phil to come up with something that's really, really good. You know, I've been debating that very thing the last 2 or 3 weeks. Is it less complicated for me now or more complicated for me now? If I could take back the knowledge that I have now and go to 21 years old, what would I do differently? I'm not sure I'd do a whole lot differently, to be honest with you. One thing that I've learned through all the teaching process is the importance of club face awareness, but I felt like I always was fairly aware of where my club face was at. So, you know, the golf course taught me that. Shaping shots taught me that. I'm glad I lived in an era when the ball spun a little bit more, so it was easier to shape a shot. But answering Phil's question, I'd say I wouldn't change much.
One of the things I always talk about with you and talk about on here really is, if I could go back, I would have realized that, I mean, I was trying to play professionally. I would have realized that everybody had the same demons. Everybody was as fragile as I was. I always put you guys, you tour players, on pedestals. And obviously you guys were really, really good, but always thinking that your mind was a steel trap and you never doubted yourself and you weren't fragile, like the word we always use. And if I could go back, I would have tried to convince myself that you guys struggled with the same things that I was struggling with, and that it's just part of the journey. And then I would have tried to be way more process oriented and not put so many ultimatums on myself, or not, if I don't hit this shot, I can't play, or, you know, so much outcome based rather than process based. Hard to do, but that's what I would have tried
to do. So I need to add something based on that. You and I both took his question differently.
Okay.
I took it from a swing standpoint and you took it from a mental standpoint. It would have been the exact opposite when I was 21 years old. I would have taken it from a mental standpoint and you probably would have taken it from a swing standpoint. What do you think about that, Jason?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I back then it was all swing all the time. And you would think, I mean, my MO as a golf instructor is, you know, to teach the golf swing. And I love nerding out. We got to speak with Carl Morris a couple nights ago, and we talked about golf swing, and I'm a golf nerd and I like to do all that stuff. But I've learned a lot about, you know, just, you can't play great golf if we're worried about outcome, if we're worried about stuff we can't control. And for me to perform better, because, you know, you performed well enough, you won 14 times and got out there, and I didn't. So the reason that I think I didn't make it was because of, I hit a lot of good shots, but I hit a ton of bad ones, but my bad ones were more so me not locked into the right stuff mentally and making free swings versus trying to steer it around and try to control the golf ball too much.
Well, I think the point I was trying to make is we've both gone different directions since we don't play. I've gone into swing more. I really like the before how, to be honest with you.
Well, again, the before how played a lot more golf. It's hard. It's just hard to go out and play once or twice and every once or twice a month or once or twice a quarter and know where the ball's going. And especially for you that played at such a high level, you've got all these past expectations that you think you need to live up to. And that's what we all, you know, especially guys that, you know, we get it a lot over here, a lot of Champions members that come over and play the game at a high level. And now they don't play as much and the body's breaking down a little bit and they have all these expectations and they, you know, they can't quite live up to them. And it's just it's a vicious cycle.
Oh yeah.
All right. Number two, this one's a good one. This guy says he's been making lots of improvements on the range, hitting it great on the range. But there's a breakdown in the transfer to the course or to competition. I think this one's always one of those, this one's kind of the holy grail of golf and of any kind of performance. And it's one of the things that I think we try to get into the minds of the sports psychologists, the performance coaches and past players to figure out this question. What are your first thoughts when you hear the question?
Well, we all have a past every time we hit the golf course, you know, and we've been working on, and that past, unfortunately, the negative stands out more than the positive sometimes. And, you know, we're working on something on the range. It begins to feel pretty good to us. We're able to achieve it on the range, but that's wide open and it really doesn't matter because I got another ball right here that I can hit again. So we're going to move over to the golf course now. And by the way, it's fixing to count. I'm going to have to go hit this next shot from wherever it's from. And it's really difficult to leave the past behind and step into the future. And, you know, the future's unknown. The past is already played out.
Yeah.
And it makes a big impression on us sometimes.
And I think we fail sometimes when we're on the range at remembering that we did hit some bad shots too. Meaning, you know, on the range, we talked about this a long time ago in one of our first podcasts together, but on the range, you can hit 100 shots in the span of 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever it is, you know, but you go on the course and you hit 75 shots, you hit 15, 20, 30 full ones in the span of 4.5 hours. So I think one of the keys in the transfer, you know, we had Dr. Wu Wu on and he talked about the transfer from the range to the course. I think one of the keys in the transfer is trying to hit less shots on the range, especially when you start to kind of get in a groove, like go sit down or go walk around or kind of break up the time, because on the range you can hit a bad shot and just like you said, you got another ball right next to you and you can kind of hit a good one and you're like, I got it again. But on the course you hit a bad shot and you've got 4 or 5 minutes, 3 or 4 minutes driving or walking to your ball to think about it the whole time. So that would be the first thing I would do. And then one of the things that you talk about all the time is spend more time on the golf course. So even when you're making swing changes or you're working at it, go out on the course and hit 2 or 3 shots and go out late in the day or super early in the morning and get out ahead of the groups or whatever. I know it's tougher with how busy golf courses are now, but go play as much, go do it as much on the course because the circumstances completely change versus that pretty flat, as you mentioned, versus that pretty flat driving range.
Same lie, same position in the stance,
yep.
Same wind, same everything on the range.
Yep.
Nothing changes.
and rapid fire, you can correct that bad miss really quickly versus, you know, you shank one into a bunker, you got to go drive up there and go get it. And it's a 3 or 4 minute delay between the shots. I think that the time difference, that would have been something I would have liked to have thought about when I was younger, the time difference on the range versus I was stupid. I never really thought about any of this stuff. So here's an interesting question. Thoughts on ball position off the left heel for all shots, not including punt shots or knockdowns, or basically, you know, he asked, does a consistent ball position make the bottom of the swing arc more predictable? So there's been a bunch of instructors that have come out and said, put the ball in the same spot for every club. And then there's been a lot of players that didn't. Where do you lie in the debate?
I don't think anything's the same on the golf course, to be honest with you. I think it's everything moved around for me a little bit. I'm not sure. I think many things are the same. We strive for it, but I don't think it ever is that much.
Could we break it down and say, you know, five handicaps and below can be variable and five or, and again, this is oversimplified too, but you know, if you're a beginner golfer, putting the ball position in just about the same spot every time for irons and then move the driver and the three wood and the longer clubs a little more forward may make it a bit simpler. But I was the same way. I mean, growing up in Oklahoma, I mean, I moved the ball around everywhere. Wedges, you know, one of the rules of thumbs that I think I had a coach tell me one time was the pitching wedge, the ball needs to be right in the middle of the stance for a pitching wedge, and then everything moves incrementally forward from there. And I think for stock shots, I don't think that's a bad idea. I just don't necessarily like a pitching wedge way off the left shoulder. I think that's, talk about low point control, that can be kind of tough and can cause some chunks and cause the ball to be hit too high and just some issues.
Well, I there's been several people say something about Jimmy Ballard. You know, one of the things that Jimmy Ballard used to do is constantly tell people to put the ball way up on their left heel and chase it all the time. Chase it, chase it, chase it. And I just never could do that. That was something that I was never, ever efficient at. I could put it up there for the driver. You know, I had better contact when the ball was back a little bit with my longer irons. And, you know, my short irons got to the middle of my stance. I just had a better feel for the game at that. To me, as I've gotten deeper into giving lessons and all that sort of stuff, I don't think there is a theory we can follow. I mean, if people come in here and they chase in to out or whatever they do, you know, I'm looking for their best, whatever they can do the best, you know, ball position, where does it fit you the best? And, there's not a standard for Hal Sutton. I don't know. I don't think there is for you either. Is there?
No. I tell young instructors when they come in here and they'll shadow or even students, like, If you listen to me teach for a couple of days in a row, I'm going to contradict myself a bunch. Like, I'm going to tell some people to move it forward, some people to move it back, some people just based off, like you said, based off the circumstances, what are their misses? And I think, again, to your point, I think we need to do a better job as an industry to again, figure out what works the best for the person in front of you or person in front of them. And then let them do it. You couldn't move it that far forward, but Jimmy had kind of a method that he taught at the time where he put everybody in the same spot, but that didn't work for Hal. And you were a good enough player that he needed to, in my opinion, needed to let you go down that route. And luckily you were, say, hard-headed enough or confident enough to say, I can't do that. And I'm not going to do that. I'm better and I'm good enough this way. I don't think we do that as, you know, we had a student yesterday asking about grip, and he was wondering if it needed to be a little bit more in his fingers of his right or left hand or a little bit less in his fingers of his left hand. And we both kind of said the same thing, like, go try it. Probably not going to change your life either direction, but go try it and see what works best for you.
Yeah. I never really, back whenever I was working with Jimmy, I was still working with Floyd Horgan on the side. Every time I'd go see Jimmy, he'd have me move the ball way up. I'd go see Floyd. He said, man, the ball's too far forward. So I had the best of both worlds. You know, they were both probably at both extremes, and, you know, I'd meet in the middle somewhere.
you had good buffers on both sides of the bowling lane, keeping you off the gutters.
Yeah.
What do all great wedge players have in common?
Well, I think they learned how to flight the ball. I mean, they don't hit the wedges as high as I think the common person out there thinks they hit it.
Amen.
And, all the best wedge players that I saw, it looked like a driving shot. It was more of a descending, driving, draw bass type shot. And
amen.
Every time I really felt like I was on the money with my wedges, I felt like I was on top of the ball. The ball was pinched off of the ground, and it took off more of a driving kind of shot with a little bit, like I said, draw bass.
Yeah. Amen. I'm looking up something real quick. And that's one thing that we talk about all the time in here. Tour average launch angles with wedges are much lower than most amateurs that come in here. There was a study. Basically, what the study showed was that the apex, the average height of every shot hit by a tour player is about the same height. It's about 30 yards. And so if you think about it, just most players that hit wedges, or if a beginning golfer hits a wedge, they're going to hit it high or higher than they think they would hit a 3-iron or a 4-iron in the max height. But on average, tour players hit their long iron. You guys hit your long irons higher than amateurs do, and you hit your wedges much, much, much lower than amateurs do. I wrote down three things real quick for this one. I said speed control, trajectory control, and low point control. And really, it's probably, to your point, it's probably speed control and trajectory, because if you can control your trajectory, you can control your low point. But those are the two. Very rarely do you see good wedge players swinging it as hard as they can with a wedge, because it goes too high. So it eliminates their ability to control trajectory, and they put too much spin on it. But hitting low little driving wedges, guys like Jordan Spieth, guys like Seve, guys like Trevino hit really low little spinny wedges versus throwing that thing up in the air and having the wind influence or not knowing where it came down. All right. We have two questions on handicap. How to get from a 13 down to a 9, and how to get from a 2 to a +2.
Go ahead and go.
So my first thought is, and this kind of again goes back to all the great guests we've had on here, like I think if you're a 13 handicap or even a 2 handicap, I think it comes back to, again, you got to take great inventory of your game, and you've got to figure out where your biggest weakness is. What's costing you the most shots? Is it course management? Is it how you hit with a 13, especially how you hit driver? What is it? And I don't think the goal is necessarily 9. I think the goal is you got to get to 12 first. I think it's step by step and work your way down, one handicap level at a time. I think a 13 is going to have more physical issues, and I think the 2 is going to be more mental commitment issues. I think if you're down to a 2 handicap, you're obviously a good player. You do a lot of good things right. And again, I think inventory is as important or even more important to figure out, how you say strengths and weaknesses. And you got to be careful if you, especially at the tour level, I completely agree with this, because you can't lose your strength at the tour level and still be at the tour level. But I also think, systems like Decade and whatnot, the stat keeping systems, will help you figure out where you're lacking the most, where you're giving up the most shots, and then you strive for that. But I would go deep into trying to set a goal of, my goal is to get to 9, and set a goal more of how am I going to get to the next level? What's the next level? And the next level is a 12. How do I get there? And then just keep going and then keep going, because the next thing you might be down to a 6 or 7 when the goal was 9. Or you may find that you don't quite have enough time and can't work at it enough to get to 9. And at this point, with the amount you practice, 10's the best you can do. And I think that's where, one step at a time versus throwing that carrot too far out there, and then you're not sure how to attain those goals. I think one spot at a time is more the goal.
Well, I think the biggest thing you said there that resonated with me was, it's more physical from a 13 to a 9. and is more mental from a two to a plus two. I would add one more thing to the plus, from the two to the plus two. It's emotional too.
Yeah.
Controlling your emotions as well as your mental decision making and commitment level to each shot, putting it behind you, moving on to the next one, and playing at the correct pace mentally. Now, that same thing could be true from the 13 to the 9. It's just not as fragile for him as it is for the guy going from a 2 to a plus 2.
Yeah, like if we have a bunch of 13 handicaps come in and hit a bunch of shots and we go watch them play for a couple of days, we're going to find a host of things that they can improve on from a let's say, a mechanical standpoint. There's a lot of twos that'll come in here and it's like, dude, it's pretty good. Your golf swing's pretty good. Your putting stroke's pretty good. Short game's pretty good. Like, where are you giving up shots? And then that's where you almost have to get the microscope out even more from a psychological standpoint, an emotional standpoint, and really look under a bunch of rocks to figure out where they can gain a shot or two here or there.
Yeah. The harder, I had a kid in here the other day that I said, you know, you've gained so much from this, from where you started to where you are right now, but the rest of the game going forward is going to be much harder than what you've had so far. And that is true across the board with golfers. The better you get, the harder it is to gain more progress.
Yeah, it's simple to say this, but it's so true. And a lot of them don't think about it. To take the 13 to a 6, you got to cut their handicap in half. To take a 2 to a 1, you have to cut their handicap in half. That's the same amount of improvement, but the 2 handicap doesn't necessarily see it like that. And that's, to your point, that's why it's so, you know, it's just so difficult.
Right.
This one's a great one. How to right the ship when you get off to a terrible start?
Well, that's an emotional roller coaster that we just talked about a little bit. You know, I mean, when you get off to a terrible start, emotionally, you're let down, you're off track. To regroup and move on, I was never able to do that except for one way. The very next shot, all I could do was do the best I could with the very next shot. I couldn't look at the hole. I had to look at the piece. And, you know, that's the only advice I've got for that. I mean, my dad used to tell me when he was watching me, he said, I'd a whole lot rather see you bogey the first hole than I had birdie the first hole. And I used to say, why do you say that? And he said, to me, you tightened everything up and made sure you were on the money from there on once you made a bogey. So I guess he thought I was better at riding the ship rather than navigating a good start.
Yeah, I think for me, when I did it, I would struggle with the fact that, I went out there with an expectation. I wanted to shoot under par, or I wanted to do this, or I was, again, too outcome-based. And then I'd go double the first hole or make a couple bogeys starting out or whatever, get off to a bad start. And then I was like, oh, well, now I can't attain my goal. And so now we start making bad decisions. I start taking on too many flags. I start trying to get back to be able to shoot under par. I got to make a bunch of birdies. Where I wish I would have thought about it more like, hey, some days 78's the best I could possibly shoot. And in that instance, like saying what you said, it goes back to how can I stay in the moment? How can I be present? How can I make free swings over every shot? Like, can I try to control my emotions and my process over every shot from here on out? And whatever I shoot is whatever I shoot. And I think if we could stick with that, again, we keep preaching this and it's so hard, but if we could stick with that concept of literally one step at a time, literally one shot at a time, then that's the only way to right the wrong. You can make a little bit of a swing tweak, like a little bit of an intention change. If it's, you know, you're snap hooking it or doing something, the ball's going way offline, but it comes back down to, you know, like Dr. Carl Morris said, what's your intention? Where's your attention? And then can you accept the shot, the result? And it all boils down to something simple like that. You can't be thinking about the outcome. Oh, I can't break 80 today because I made triple on the first two holes. No, you have to simplify it and go back to one shot at a time, one thought at a time, commit to everything you're trying to do. Importance of playing the front tees.
For all those people out there that are trying to learn how to score better, playing the front tee is can challenge you on that. It offers a shorter golf course, but it offers different looks. You know, and every time you get under par, you know, we try to get all of our kids to do this, you know, get under par and feel nervous about getting the best round you've ever shot in. You know, I mean, it teaches you a whole different emotional game by getting up on the front tees. You know, I never will forget the first time I was trying to break par. You know, I mean, I was getting in, you know, I'm even par. I got a hole to go. You know, all I got to do is make par, and somehow I mess it up. Then finally I break par. And then next thing you know, I'm trying to break 60, break 70. That's the next hurdle, you know, and it's so hard to break those hurdles. And, you know, playing the front tees can help you learn how to manage those emotions.
Amen. No, there's not a whole lot to add. It helps lower your comfort zone. And whether that's breaking it, like breaking 80 the first time, breaking 90 the first time, go play up and figure out how to score. Like you said, it presents you with different circumstances. You hit more wedges than you're used to. You have to hit different shots off the tee. You have to think about certain holes a little differently because it brings trouble into play. But to me, I think it's so important, as you said, from an emotional standpoint. How can you handle your emotions coming down the stretch when you have a chance to shoot your lowest score? And that's what we have to keep putting ourselves in those situations so that way we can, you know, break through the glass ceiling at some point. How to get rid of shanks. This listener said, when I think I got it fixed, they come back, tends to ruin the round, and I feel paralyzed.
Well, I'm not real sure how to answer that. I never really had the shanks, so I never struggled from that. So what do you think, Chase?
One of the things I would say is that it's not people think the shanks are like this incurable disease that you can't fix, like they're just around forever. It's kind of like the yips. Like a lot of people kind of think shanks and the yips go hand in hand. And to me, I think they're totally different. Like there's a lot of people that fight hitting it off the toe, but they don't think of that as bad as the shanks. And to me, they're the same thing. If you're fighting off the heel, you're skilled at hitting off the heel. Like look at it like that. And you've got to become more skilled at hitting it closer to the toe. There's something physically happening that is causing you to hit off the heel. One of the things that one of the drills that I love to do, and it's the exact opposite of most of what you guys would think, set up to a ball on the hosel and then try to hit it solid. Most players are going to move farther away from it. They're going to get it closer to the toe, which is going to incentivize you to move farther out, get the heel farther out towards the ball, which is going to incentivize you to make the move that is causing you to shank it. There's two great drills. Set up to a ball on the heel and then like on the hosel and then try to hit it solid. The second drill is to set up to a ball normally, make a full swing. You have to hit the ground but miss the golf ball. So you have to hit the ground inside between your ball and the feet, because again, we're trying to get that club to move closer to you, to get closer to your body versus farther away from you. You can only shank it off the heel, off the hosel. It's the only way you can shank it. Technically you can toe shank it, but they're completely different issues. So for me, my dad fights shanks every now and then. He's got a bad back and kind of extends a little bit, and so the big thing for him was he would shank one and like quit, like, cause he didn't want to do it again. He didn't know how to fix it. And the big thing for him was understanding, okay, this is what I'm doing when I shank it. So that way you hit one, just like, this is what I do when I pull hook it. This is what I do when I slice it. And so you know how to fix it versus this idea that, oh my gosh, I'm shanking it. I've got this disease, that this incurable disease that I can't fix. Look at it like I'm just hitting it off the hosel. I need to move it towards the toe versus panicking and thinking I can't, there's nothing I can do to rectify this. Any thoughts on that? I love guys that come in that fight shanks, because you can, in my opinion, you can usually see the problem and fix them pretty easily. And then they think you actually know what you're doing. They think you hung the moon.
Well, it can be fixed. There's no, you know, one of the things that we try to do in golf is to create some sort of standard for both good and bad. You know, is there a standard for what people are doing that is shanking? The only common thing is they're hitting it in the heel.
Yep.
They could be doing 50 different things to cause hitting it in the heel.
Right.
And so, you know, there's nothing we can talk about that is a cure for everybody on here. It's just, you know, there is no standard in golf. That's just the one thing that I'm going to say.
Yeah. And that drill, have five different people come in here and that are fighting shanks. That drill will work with all five, but to your point, they're going to have to make five different motions to make the club move the way we want it to move. And then you let them come up with whatever feel that is versus us trying to write an article in Golf Digest that says, if you're shanking it, do this one move. No, do this drill and tell us what move you made to make it work.
Right.
Anything else? Are you going to say anything else?
No.
Okay. Best method for improving long irons misses normally too far to the right.
Well.
Kind of your answer is probably going to be similar, right? Like until you get them in here and look at them like that. Sometimes that's a hard question to answer.
That's a hard question to answer. It's harder. We've said on here a bunch of times, it's easier to draw loft and easier to fade less loft. Mm-hmm. And that's just true. And, you know, one of the things that I had to get across to myself in order to learn how to hit a good long iron, I kept trying to get it in the air when I was younger, you know, and I'd try to stay back to get it in the air. It changed my low point and everything else. And I realized finally that you got to hit down to make the ball go up. Utilize the loft that you do have, whatever it is.
Yeah. And I think to your point about drawing loft versus fading less loft, I think what I would ask is if they hit a pured 8 iron or a pured 9 iron, is it drawing a little bit or is it dead straight or even falling right? And if the lofted clubs are falling right a little bit, then we know it's a club face issue or we know that we're coming over the top of it or whatever that is. Versus if we go full rip 8 iron, that ball needs to turn over just a little bit. So that way the longer irons don't get too wipey. And that's something that's kind of one of those kind of general rules that we use with a lot of players in here. If they're going to go full send 9 iron or 8 iron, it probably needs to draw just a touch, or they're going to hit fades with the longer stuff. If that's not what they want, then we need to make a change. Okay. A little bit of a change of direction for this question. We got a couple little change of directions. So 81 Walker Cup at Cypress Point. Where does that rank in some of your golf memories?
That was a special time, to be honest with you. We had a really, really good team, and what no greater atmosphere than Cypress Point and Pebble Beach. I played with Jay Siegel as a partner that week, and Jay was a great amateur player, went on and had a really great year, a great career on the Champions Tour as well. So, you know, that was high up. Cypress Point special, I've said it 1,000 times. If God came down and said, Hal, you got 24 hours, where do you want to play your last round? I'd say, I want the first tee time at Pebble Beach. And as soon as I finish, I'm running over to Cypress Point. I'm going to play there. I'm going to get 36 in the last day. So
you're going to be tired doing it, but you're going to go out with a bang, right?
I don't think I can play 36 right now. So maybe we play the back nine at Pebble Beach. And the back nine at Cypress Point.
Here, you get the last round at Pebble on a Thursday, and then you get the first round at Cypress on a Friday, and then you can spread it out a little bit. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I couldn't play 36 holes right now. I'd be worn out. Do you think PEDs were used back in your day, beta blockers, etc., before they started testing on the PGA Tour?
Well, I don't know how I'd know that. I know Hal Sutton didn't, but
right.
I really don't know the answer to that. I think I know that with a doctor's excuse, they could use beta blockers, you know, for heart issues and things like that. But, you know, my knowledge of beta blockers, I wouldn't want to use them anyway because they make everything even keel, you know, and I played my best golf when I was a little bit hyped,
yeah.
You know, a little bit. I needed to be able to get, come on, let's go. And I know from the knowledge that I have of beta blockers, what I've read is they kind of tend to make everything even keel.
Yep.
I didn't want to be that way.
Well, and to your point too, about kind of being hyped up a little bit, like what we've learned with some of the sports psychs we talked to, the performance guys, like being hyped up a little bit is how we get closer to flow state, being in the zone, all that stuff. Like, again, if you're rock climbing, you need to be hyped up or you're not going to be focused, versus if you're on beta blockers when you're doing some of that stuff, like you don't want to be just, you know, even killed and too calm. Like we're designed as humans to perform our best when we're a little bit on edge. So I think that's a great answer. Any courses you played in tournaments where the course didn't fit your eye? How did you overcome that? Did you change your game plan at all?
If it didn't fit my eye, I usually played a little bit more conservative game. I didn't push the envelope. If I didn't feel confident, you know, the best way I can describe this where everybody can understand it, if I got to a hole that my shape of shot just didn't fit the drive, and the drive was a little bit of a demanding drive that I really had to hit the shot, then I'd back off and hit the shot I knew I could. You know, I used a three wood a lot off of the tee and used to see that a lot. In my era, you know, one thing that people don't realize, Jack Nicklaus was one of the best three wood players off the tee of anybody. And he was never afraid to use his three wood off the tee. And, you know, I used it a lot too. We've talked about it. You're able to draw loft a little bit better. I was always able to draw my three wood easier than I could draw my driver. So if there were trouble on the right and I needed to draw it away from it a little bit, a lot of times three wood was my first option on that. Yeah. You know, and it just didn't fit my eye with a driver. So I'd go the other direction.
Yeah, I mean, some of the new math with Fawcett and Mark Brody and those guys say, you know, get it down there as far as you can, go bomb driver. So I think that's probably why you've seen a bigger movement away from, you know, hitting less club off the tee to find fairways. But I want to kind of, that brings up another question that this is just me asking because I think it's interesting. What are your thoughts on Kisner? And what I mean by that is Kisner saying like he knows he's not going to win at a U.S. Open at Bethpage. Kind of that mindset where he's, they asked him, well, why show up? And he said, well, because they pay a lot for 20th place. And while you didn't say that in your answer to that last question, but you kind of did on shots that didn't fit your eye, you kind of backed off a little bit and your expectation levels were a little different. What are your thoughts when you hear Kisner say that?
Well, first of all, I think he's being honest. I think he knows that he doesn't have a powerful enough game to win at Bethpage and in a U.S. Open format. I'm telling you, Bethpage is one of the hardest golf courses in the world. I mean, to me, having correct expectations allows you to play to the best of your ability at whatever tournament you're playing in. And to Kisner's point, they do pay a lot of money for 20th place. And, you know, if you knew you were fixing to finish 20th in the U.S. Open, you'd go, wouldn't you, Chase?
Of course.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, winning, I've said this a million times over here, winning runs into you. You don't run into winning. Now, you do so many things that lead up to that really caused it to run into you.
Right.
There were months out that people are working on things, you know, with kids in here, college kids or whatever. We're working on stuff. They're working hard. They're getting better. They're getting better. And then all of a sudden they win. You know, it's not, well, I didn't go out there and just try to win this time. I've been working on this for months, you know, and that's what happens in golf. But having the correct expectation, you know, it's like kids are better at it today. You know, they're going out there believing that they should be able to win on the PGA Tour right off the bat. So that's changing some. But I think Kevin Kisner has his attitude in a lot better spot when he says, I can't win at Bethpage.
Yeah. And I also think it helps him too. If he finishes 40th or misses the cut, it helps him be ready for the next event a little bit quicker versus if he's expecting to go out there and win. And then, you know, again, like my fragile mind at times back then would have said, oh, I got to change something because I didn't have a chance this week or I didn't compete, where he's like, golf course was tough. I'll be ready for the next one, you know? And I think that there's a lot to that, not letting golf beat him up too much when he's playing courses that just don't fit him as well. Up question here. What Bryson has done, do you think it's productive or harmful to his ability to win golf tournaments?
Ooh. I don't know about that. I'm wondering if it's been productive for him physically or not, you know? I mean, I can't answer that question. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, I think some of the speed stuff, I think when he first started to do it, he was never thinking of long drive contests. I think he was just trying to hit it farther to have a better chance on the PGA Tour. And he won a US Open and had a bad back nine at the next US Open, I think it was, or British or wherever it was, but had a chance to win another one and then just didn't play well on the back, but on Sunday. But to me, once he started getting in the long drive, then that's what, because I've always said, I thought he kind of trained to do this, but once he started getting in the long drive, like, I don't, you know, does it hurt his ability to win golf tournaments? My question would be, would you rather be Kyle Berkshire and the longest guy in the world, or would you rather be the best player in the world? And I'd love to see how he would answer that. Cause I almost feel like now he kind of likes the long drive stuff, and he's almost been training and pushing for that versus necessarily trying to be Scottie Scheffler or be better than Scottie Scheffler and be the number one player in the world. Without asking him, well, I guess we'll never know. How do we initiate the downswing back to golf swing stuff?
How do we initiate the downswing?
Yeah, how do we initiate the downswing?
So that, to me, is one of those, we'll never get a standard answer on that. You know, I had a debate. I'll never forget this one time. Gary Player and Lee Trevino, and I think Raymond Floyd was in this conversation. And we were all talking about that. And there was no similar answer.
What y'all did, all that was different?
Yes. I mean, and I don't even remember what everybody said. It's just we all thought something different at the time.
From a scientific standpoint, the feet move, the weight moves first, then the legs, then the hips. Really, the hips go before everything else. Just about everybody that was any good, the hips start to unwind before the upper body starts down. But as we've talked about a ton on here, if that's your intention, it can lead to hips going too far too fast and getting into a really, really tough spot. So a lot of players have the intention, the feel that their arms are starting down, but really the hips will always initiate the downswing. But that's where you've got to get somebody that can look under the hood and see what the problem is and make sure that your hips aren't going too fast or your arms aren't going too fast or whatever your issue is. Science is the hips, but intention and feel and all that stuff is where, you know, the debates, like you mentioned, how can be all over the board, feel versus real, all that stuff. Ever change your swing thought in the middle of a tournament?
Never.
Never? Didn't ever tweak it at all? Never. I didn't think you'd answer
well,
that.
Well, no, not really. I really never did change much.
That's awesome.
Change from week to week sometimes, but my swing thought, pretty much the same most of the time. You know, whatever it was, you know, it was different things.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So you would change week to week, but not necessarily round to round.
Not necessarily shot to shot.
Yeah. This one's a good one.
That is. Borrowing, I don't have to hit a cut shot all of a sudden.
Yeah, different types.
I'm talking about just a standard shot.
Yeah, standard drive off a tee. You're not trying to do anything with it. You're trying to do the same thing. Yeah.
Right.
My swing's all over the place, so I definitely had to change sometimes to get through a round or get through. And again, I was too much mechanical, so I would probably be. I would say maybe once a different cue at times to get through some misses or whatever, but much less than I would have when I was 20, 22, 23 and crazy. This one's a good one. Slap release, like a Victor Hovland or a DJ type release style versus a traditional full release with more toe up to toe up rotation, like a Phil, a VJ or a Louis Oosthuizen. This one's, I love these types of questions.
Well, go ahead and get going on it then.
So it's all about wrist angles in the backswing for me. If you look at Victor and DJ are more closed face players in the back on the backswing. So they're going to have to hold the face off and they're going to have to add loft and do some stuff to it to make it work. Phil, BJ, Louis are more square face players at the top. So they're going to have a bit more rotation. Now, here's the fun part to this. There's been tons of studies done by a bunch of smarter scientists and crazy people and much smarter than I that have done tons of studies that show that that one's not better than the other. If you're fighting slices, you know, the Victor Hovland DJ backswing might make more sense to you. If you're fighting hooks, the Phil and VJ and Louis backswing might make more sense to you. But as far as, again, this goes back to there's not one size that fits all. How's your wrist structures? How do you move naturally? How do you grip it? How do you set up to it? You know, what's your range of motion with your elbows? All that stuff plays a big factor into how to move. And if you're a fairly good player that's trying to decide which one makes more sense to him, I don't think you can. I think you just go to a decent instructor and figure out your issues, because if you've played one way versus the other, trying to move into the other way is usually a recipe for disaster.
So can I say something here that is a little bit off subject, but it's not based on what you just talked about?
Sure.
Would we all love the game if the starting point was the same, the journey to get to the finish line was exactly the same? Would we love the game nearly as much?
No,
we would not. But yet we're all trying to figure out the easiest path to get to the end finish line.
Yep.
And, you know, it's different for all of us. That's what we love about the game. So yep. Why not just embrace your own personal journey and figure out what that is and how to get better on that personal journey?
Because not all of us got to hit it as good as you did all your life. And we're all trying to strive to be that way. Like,
hey, listen, man, I stand humbled after the last time I played, because I hit some shots that I never dreamed Hal Sutton would hit. So,
all right, I love that. We got four more questions. We'll rapid fire them real quick. Struggling with chipping, thoughts on wrist movements? Keep them passive. Here's another trying to kind of pin us down. Keep them passive or some movement?
Well, go ahead.
I think you're one or the other. I think you're Steve Stricker or you're Seve. And I think you can use both at times. But I think your stock shots need to be who you are. I tend to teach more wrists, softer wrists, let the hands move a little bit and not super rigid and super structured, because I think it's a harder way to teach it. But I think whichever one is natural for you, I think you start there and then figure out what's going on. I just don't like tension. So I like the grip pressure to be soft enough to let them move a little bit. But again, you know, you look at Jason Day, you look at Steve Stricker, they have very little set and they were more tilty and more pivot based. I could never hit chip shots like that. And so I tend, my preference is more on that other side.
Tension is a killer. That's all I'm going to say.
And you were a little bit more on the less, you kind of set it more with your arms. We've talked about this a ton versus being a quick wrist setter.
Yeah. I didn't have a real quick set. So, you know, Seve tried to help me fix that a long time ago and he wasn't very successful at it. So,
modern bunker technique versus old school technique. I thought this question was kind of interesting. I'll go real quick and then get your take. Modern bunker technique, I would say the only difference is we're not teaching open stances and aiming left as much in bunkers as I think you guys were taught. And I think a lot of it's just because we don't hit the ball, we're hitting the sand. And so like, if I was going to teach bunker to a mass group of people, I would say throw the sand where you want to hit the shot. And a lot of people talk about kind of drawing their bunker shots a little bit more from an open face versus kind of slicing across it. But I mean, I would say if you took the five best bunker players in your era, Hal, versus the five best bunker players today, I don't know who they are, their techniques are going to look kind of similar. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. You know, the one thing that, you know, even though we aim left and everything, the ball doesn't come out left.
Yeah.
And
because again, we're not hitting the ball and the face is wide open. So we're adding loft. We're not opening the face.
Right.
We're not aiming the face more right. We're aiming it more up.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the point. And, you know, it's funny. I knew that because I played enough shots, but I still, my brain was locked in. I was aimed left. So it's funny. I was a good bunker player, but I will guarantee you I missed more bunker shots left of the hole than I did right of the hole. And, you know, but I look back now and I know now that I know that as we open the face, it's going more up instead of left.
What does a high golf IQ mean? And is it different? Does a high golf IQ mean the same as having a high basketball IQ or having a high football IQ?
That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. I know to me, a high golf IQ is a guy that's played a lot of golf and understands and can feel the game. It's not necessarily a swing IQ.
I keep wanting to say experience.
Yeah, experience. That's really the word I'm looking for.
I think to your point, you said that the kids now are winning at an earlier rate. I think it's because they're learning how to play the game the right way, or based off math and science and all that stuff, based off decision. They're learning how to make the right decisions faster than you guys. You guys tended to get out there and experience it, and they're a little bit more, not experienced, but just they're just more ready.
Well, the reason why they're more ready is because of a thing called the AJGA, where they're playing 2-, 3-, and 4-day tournaments now. Whenever I was in high school, we played 1-day tournaments.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point.
To string 2 rounds together, much less 3 rounds together. That's experience.
That's a great point. All right, last question. Talk about Augusta. How difficult the walk is. Augusta's coming up in a week or so. What it is mentally like to play? Is the atmosphere in the locker room any different than normal events? Did you have more ticket requests? How are the patrons? Amen Corner different than other tough 3-hole stretches? So give us a quick rundown of Augusta.
I was going to say that's about 10 questions. Well, you know, I was never a big fan of Augusta. We talked about it, didn't fit my eye. We asked that question earlier. It didn't fit my eye. Felt like I was always having to reinvent a new house up to go to Augusta. It was always tough whenever it was during my era because they had they had autograph policy of none. So in between every green and every tee you'd sign, it seemed like 100 autographs in between each time. The walk is very difficult. It's way more up and down than you think it is. Lots of uphill shots, not a lot of downhill shots. The locker room at the time that I was playing, things have changed, and I haven't been back. But most of the time, there was 2 people in the locker room. They didn't have as many, in a single locker. So they didn't have a lot of lockers. And, in the locker room, there was a special place where everybody ate. There weren't a bunch of 4 top tables. Usually there was 1 really big table and people just sat down at the same big table where everybody talked. That was way different than what a normal tour event is. So to me, Augusta had a completely different feel than any other tournament we played in. From the minute you drove in the gate until the minute you left, it felt difficult. Getting down Washington Avenue was the hardest thing in the world. I felt like I'd been through a fight by the time I got in the parking lot, just trying to, because they had 1 gate to get in, basically. And everybody's coming down Washington Avenue to get in. You didn't drive down Magnolia Lane. You came in another gate. And they shut Magnolia Lane down whenever the tournament starts. So, I could talk about Augusta all day long. There is, it's why we look forward to it. It's the first major. It's beautiful. It's springtime. And we've got a new year right here in front of us. You know, every golfer that's out there, all you that are listening right now, your golf season is just starting right now. You know, and all these pros are 3 months deep into their golf season right now. So it's all, we're watching them tournament ready, and we're not quite tournament ready, but we're ready to be tournament ready.
Well, speaking of tournament ready, let's hope that somebody that's not going to be tournament ready, but we hope he plays. Let's hope Tiger can pull it off and go play. He's been working hard from what it sounds like. So it'll be exciting to see if next week at this time, if he's teamed up.
I bet we see Tiger play the par three with Charlie, and I bet we don't see Tiger yet. If I know Tiger Woods a little bit, he's not going to play until he actually thinks he has a chance. Now, I hope he thinks he has a chance and plays.
I definitely hope you're wrong, but we will find out soon enough. Hal, thanks. This was fun as always, guys. We will see you. We will see you next time.
Be the right club today. Yes!